A nurse brought us dinner, and we ate there in Dr. Winkler's office. Mr. Smith fell asleep on the sofa soon afterward. I moved the simulation equipment out to the lounge and connected the big television to the NASA feed. Then I returned to Dr. Winkler's office. The flight team was discussing possibly changing the rendezvous sequence. Because the batteries in the spacesuits had only a few hours left, the initial decision was to fly something called a direct ascent. But Mr. Smith had advised against it, saying that direct ascent was too risky for Apollo. As a result, Flight Director Taylor ordered a special Tiger team to investigate options and report back. One of the Tiger team members confirmed that direct ascent wasn't used for Apollo. Although that option is the simplest, requiring only a single burn of the ascent engine to put the LM on a path to intercept the target ship a half orbit later, the man reported, the Apollo team felt that the likelihood of variations in the thrust during ascent presented too much risk. The short duration of the approach didn't allow much time for their old computers to calculate, and the crew to execute the maneuvers to correct the flight path. If those corrections weren't made, the LM would miss the interception point and crash into the lunar surface. Couldn't the command module have changed course and rescued the LM? The flight director asked. In some cases, the man replied, but course changes require fuel, and its fuel was very limited. I assume that the computer and fuel issues do not apply in our case. That's correct, the man responded. Flight Lunar Ops, a woman's voice called. Go ahead, Lunar Ops, the flight director said. A short pause ensued. Thank you, sir. My main concern is time. No offense to the guidance team, but they were still making changes to the software half an hour ago. There's a reasonable chance that we will need Ms. Phillips to take manual control. I understand she has walked through the procedures in the cockpit, but that's no substitute for flight experience, especially with an untested vehicle. She needs time to adjust to the actual vehicle and environment. The co-elliptical sequence gives her a whole lunar orbit to do that, and also makes my job as cargo pilot easier if I have to rescue her. She's the one who will fly the cargo ship remotely. She's probably at the lunar South Pole. Flight Surgeon. Go ahead, Surgeon. Sir, I understand Lunar Ops's concern, but an extra hour trapped in that spacesuit may mean the difference between life and death for the injured historian, Dr. Canterbury. We're also concerned about Miss Phillips' state of mind. She was severely traumatized by the death of the pilot and is barely able to follow simple directions. The sooner both of them get out of those suits, the better their chances for survival. Guidance assured the flight director that the new software would support direct ascent, especially after the simulations with Mr. Smith. The flight director decided to stick with direct ascent. Flight Lunar Ops. Go ahead, Lunar Ops. Another short delay followed that I now understood was because of the distance the signal had to travel. I understand and will do my best to support the direct ascent, but I have a request. No offense to the guidance team, but speaking as a pilot, I'd feel a lot better if we have that Apollo astronaut do any flying that's necessary. You mean have Mr. Smith input the commands to the autopilot program? I'm not sure he'll be up to it. Dr. Winkler, what do you think? Sir, I'm sorry, Dr. Winkler said, but I don't know what state he will be in when he wakes up from his rest. I have some medication I can give him that should help, and George and I will do our best to remind him of the circumstances. But I suggest that you go with your original plan to have one of your astronauts run the autopilot and talk Ms. Phillips through any problems. Excuse me, flight, the flight surgeon interjected. How about if we have Mr. Smith serve as a coach for Ms. Phillips? Being a historian, having an Apollo astronaut looking over her shoulder could keep her calm and also give her the confidence she needs. That's an excellent idea, Lunar Ops said. Dr. Winkler? He glanced over at me. George, you know how he usually behaves after his afternoon naps. Think he can do it? I gulped. The fate of two people might depend on my decision. I looked at Mr. Smith sleeping peacefully. Usually, a nap reset his memory. But given the right props, I could probably get him back into his astronaut mindset in time for the launch, now only 45 minutes away. I took a deep breath and nodded, yes. I hoped I wouldn't regret this. Dr. Winkler and the Capcom, who was a current astronaut with lunar experience, agreed to do a voice check and let Mr. Smith talk to Ms. Phillips before the launch. At that time, we'd decide if he could continue on the live loop and be given command authority to the autopilot. I stood up. Dr. Winkler, I'm going to get Mr. Smith's shoes. His slippers remind him of his mother. The doctor nodded in understanding. While you're up there, see if he has a white shirt, and bring a belt, too. People used to dress up back then. Roger, I said, and dashed out for the elevator. When I returned, the liftoff was only a half hour away. Dr. Winkler was talking on his cell, something about a security team. He disconnected when he saw me and said, "Time to wake our famous moonwalker." Dr. Winkler set a wind-up alarm clock, no voice controls, next to Mr. Smith and let it ring. Mr. Smith immediately nabbed it and shut it off. He blinked and stared at Dr. Winkler, who had donned his white lab coat. "Do I know you?" he asked. Dr. Winkler explained that he was a NASA flight surgeon. He regretted waking him, but Mission Control needed Mr. Smith's assistance. "There's a mission on?" he asked, straightening up. "Yes, and they're in trouble," Dr. Winkler said as he handed him the white golf shirt I'd brought. The doctor explained what had happened to Ms. Phillips and that Mission Control wanted him to talk her through a lunar ascent and rendezvous. Mr. Smith looked confused. "We beat the Russians and quit flying to the moon," he insisted. "Yes, we did," the doctor agreed. "But then we went back to the moon as partners. Ms. Phillips was visiting the moon when the accident happened." I cringed. I wish he hadn't used the word accident. It might evoke memories of Mr. Smith's wife. But Mr. Smith was more focused on the first part of the sentence. "Partners? With the Russians? Like Apollo Soyuz?" "That's right," Dr. Winkler said. "Like Apollo Soyuz, only on the moon." "Okay," Mr. Smith said. "And they got in trouble?" "Yes," Dr. Winkler repeated. I helped Mr. Smith with his shoes and then his belt. I combed his thin white hair. He suddenly noticed me and stared at my badge. "What kind of badge is that? Are you press? Reporters aren't allowed in here." "I'm not a reporter, Mr. Smith. I'm George. I'm a member of the guidance team," I said quickly in an attempt to use an appropriate term. I thought of adding that I was in charge of the manual system, but stopped myself. "And don't call me Mr. Smith," he barked. "Makes me feel old." "Okay, Bob," I said with a wink. Dr. Winkler handed him a cup of coffee spiked with some of that pink medicine. Mr. Smith sipped it gratefully. "Ready?" Dr. Winkler asked. "Where are we going?" Mr. Smith asked. "To the hotel lobby. We've set up a direct link to Mission Control. We're going to help a young woman take off from the moon." "Better call my wife," he said. "She'll be worried." "She's visiting her mother," Dr. Winkler explained. "Oh, that's good," he said. I heard a thumping sound as we approached the double doors at the front of the building. "Whoa," I said. "There's a helicopter in the parking lot."
"Darn press," mumbled Mr. Smith.
His hands curled into fists. "No, sir, that's Homeland S- I mean, the Air Force," Dr. Winkler said.
So that's who he was talking to on the phone. Wonder what they're doing here. Oh, of course, Mr. Smith said, his hands relaxing again. A man in a black suit with a security butt in his ear was asking Yvonne a question. With her eyes as large as saucers, she pointed in our direction. The man turned toward us. I thought he looked like one of those guys who guard the president. Maybe he did. He saluted Mr. Smith as we walked past, and Mr. Smith acknowledged him with a curt nod. Then Mr. Smith blew a kiss at Yvonne, who blushed deeply enough to match the purple of the front desk. Would she guess who Mr. Smith was now? Even if she did, I realized that I would not be able to confirm her suspicions without breaking my word. I'd always thought of security as keeping bad guys out, not good guys in. Is that why DHS was here? To make sure no one tried to kidnap Mr. Smith? Age and Alzheimer's had kind of done that already. Or were they here to keep the media out in case someone leaked that one of the original moonwalkers was alive and helping them? Or both? At the doorway to the lounge, another man in black stopped us. Mr. Smith waited patiently while he asked me to raise my arms and ran a metal detector over me like they do at airports. He confiscated my phone, saying no recordings or photos were allowed. Did I understand? I didn't know if this was an act for Mr. Smith's benefit or not, but I quickly replied, "Yes, sir." Lakewood did not allow the taking of photos or videos of the residents by non-family members anyway. Now I understand just how important that rule was to someone like Mr. Smith. A nicely dressed, middle-aged woman stood up as we shuffled Mr. Smith into the darkened lounge. She pecked Mr. Smith on the cheek. "Good to see you again, Flyboy," she said. With an exaggerated wink, she added, "Name's Ruth, in case you forgot." Mr. Smith didn't show any signs of recognizing this woman, but he returned her wink and said, "I never forget a beautiful woman." Dr. Winkler explained that Ruth Pressa was the relative who had granted permission to contact Mission Control. She shook my hand warmly and whispered in my ear, "Thank you for being such a good friend to my great-grandfather. It means a lot to our family." "Her great-grandfather?" "It's my privilege, ma'am." Her badge sported the seal of the DHS and her last name at the bottom in capital letters, Pressa. I wondered what kind of work she did for them. While Dr. Winkler escorted Mr. Smith to a chair, Ms. Pressa handed me an old-fashioned wired headset and a speaker box. "This is a Mission Control headset and speaker box from the Apollo Restoration Project. I rigged up an interface so you can plug these into your laptop." She pointed to a rocker switch on the cord. "This is the push-to-talk button that he'll use to talk to Ms. Phillips. If he starts spouting nonsense, just unplug him from the laptop. He'll hear a click, tell him we lost the signal." I nodded, hoping I'd not need to do that. She continued, "The speaker box is set to broadcast and receive. The flight director and all the team will hear everything said in this room, so be careful to always call him Mr. Smith." "I understand," I said. I decided not to tell her I didn't know his real name anyway. "Okay, then, I'll let you get to work." She settled into a chair next to Dr. Winkler. I motioned Mr. Smith to join me standing behind the simulator. Our interface to Mission Control was the same setup I'd used earlier, except that I'd added some bar stools in case our feet got tired. Also, I'd left the projector off since we had live images from Mission Control. The view from Ms. Phillips' helmet cam was in the center of the screen. On the right was a graph of data from the spacesuits showing power and carbon dioxide levels and stuff like that. On the left was a plot of the planned trajectory of the direct descent rendezvous. It looked pretty simple. An arc from the surface that intersected a dotted circle around the moon. The cargo ship was marked by a yellow Pac-Man that was slowly eating its way around the dotted circle. I smiled. Someone on the flight control team had a sense of humor. I saw that movie, Mr. Smith said, looking at the TV. Isn't that the one with Tom Hanks in it? No, I said. This is a live image from the moon. There's a woman who needs to fly to lunar orbit. What's a woman doing on the moon? Is this some Russian stunt? No, she's an American, I replied patiently. Had he forgotten everything we told him already? My heart rate climbed. What's important is that if she doesn't rendezvous with a cargo ship in lunar orbit, she and the other passenger will die. Unfortunately, she's not a pilot. Mr. Smith frowned. She'll never make it. Not on her own, she won't, I said. That's why we need you. NASA has set up the computer to fly the ascent automatically. You know, like pings. I hoped I had the term right. He nodded. Pings works great, he said. I continued. Yes, and Pings was recently updated so that it can do all the calculations really fast. But it can't fly like the best LM pilot alive. No need to say the only one. He smiled at this praise. So NASA needs you to help this woman. Her name is Ms. Clara Phillips, with the launch and rendezvous. I can do that, Mr. Smith said, placing his large hand on the stick, just like he'd done hours earlier. I let out the breath I'd been holding. I looked over at Dr. Winkler, who gave me a thumbs-up sign. Mr. Smith donned the old-fashioned headset like he wore one every day. I plugged it into my laptop. If Mr. Smith got confused, I'd be responsible for literally pulling the plug. Houston would like to do a voice check on their secure line, I said. Hello, Mr. Smith. This is Houston Capcom. How do you read?
Roger, Houston. Read you five by, Mr. Smith answered.
Good. The flight director would like to speak to you.
Go ahead, Mr. Smith said.
Hello, Mr. Smith. I'm Flight Director Keegan Taylor, he said. We appreciate you helping us in this emergency. Time is short, so let me fill you in on a few details. Mr. Smith listened intently as the flight director explained that they were going to do a direct ascent and that they might need him to take over manually.
Understood, Mr. Smith said.
Oh, and if you're willing, we'd like you to talk to Ms. Phillips, tell her what to expect before it happens, keeping in mind the 1.3-second signal delay so she'll stay calm. Can you do that?
Sure,
Mr. Smith replied simply.
Good.
Then I'll have Capcom patch you through to Ms. Phillips. Her first name's Clara. The Capcom's voice came over the speaker. Clara, this is Houston on Private Channel Alpha. Do you copy? A second later, she responded,
Yes, Houston, I hear you. My hands are shaking so badly, I'm afraid I'll press the wrong buttons.
Clara, you will do fine, the Capcom assured her. You just press proceed at T5 and the computer will take it from there.
But this LM was never tested under real conditions, and I'm not a pilot.
We know that, Clara. But that engine worked on every Apollo flight, and the systems are looking good. To reassure you, we've asked a very special person to come out of retirement. I'm going to patch him through to speak to you. He wishes to keep his name secret and goes by Mr. Smith. But we have verified that he is, in fact, one of the original Apollo moonwalkers.
A second later, she said,
But that's impossible. The last one died in a car crash with his wife. I went to their funeral.
Apparently, only the wife actually died in that crash. Mr. Smith was sent to a secret location to spend his last years free of media scrutiny.
The tabloids were actually right?
Miss Phillips laughed.
Oh, my, that was insensitive of me. Is Mr. Smith listening? Please tell him I didn't mean to make light of his loss. I'm sure it must have been very hard.
Yes, Mr. Smith said. I miss my wife.
Oh, no. He mustn't start thinking about his wife right now. He'll be of no help at all.
I unplugged his connection to Ms. Phillips.
Mr. Smith, I whispered, pointing at the display. What does that light mean? He stared at the panel seen through Ms. Phillips' helmet camera.
The LM fuel tank pressure is low. Must have a leak. Better take off soon.
Good. He was back on track. I plugged him back in. I saw Miss Pressa smiling at me. The Capcom was talking to Ms. Phillips, I supposed, answering a question about how Mr. Smith had gotten involved in the rescue.
Mr. Smith heard about your situation on the news and contacted us to see if he could help. We had him fly a simulator and update the model for use in the autopilot. He's standing by to speak with you.
I can't believe this, Ms. Phillips said. I must be out of my mind or talking to a ghost.
I'm not a ghost, Mr. Smith said, and you won't be either as long as you stay calm and follow directions.
He paused in thought. I kept my finger on the plug just in case he changed subjects.
Once you reach orbit, Mr. Smith said, you'll just coast right to where the command module can get you.
Command module? Miss Phillips repeated.
He means the cargo ship,
the Capcom said. Oh, of course, I understand, Miss Phillips said. They went through some pre-flight checks of switch positions and reviewed the procedures. Mr. Smith seemed calm and in control, every bit the old Apollo astronaut. The liftoff was right on time. Miss Phillips yelped when the engine fired, but Mr. Smith soothingly told her that was nominal, a word he used instead of normal.
You'll go straight up for about 10 seconds, he reminded her. Then you'll pitch over and move horizontally with respect to the lunar surface. You should have a great view out the window.
The image of the cockpit on the TV jiggled up and down in response to the engine. No sound penetrated through the airless cockpit. The view out the window changed from black sky to lunar gray as the ship nosed down.
Guidance report, the flight director demanded.
Flight CG shifted at pitch over.
A second later, we heard Miss Phillips shout, Dr. Canterbury!
The pitch over had thrown the injured man out of his harness. One arm smacked Miss Phillips across her faceplate. I involuntarily winced and sucked in a breath, though she was perfectly fine inside her helmet. Mr. Smith spoke softly.
Miss Phillips, grab his wrist. When the ascent engine shuts down, he'll float right to you.
Flight engine shutdown.
Trajectory report, the flight director ordered.
The computer didn't fully compensate for the CG shift. We'll need a correction from the RCS.
Mr. Smith, stand by for remote ops.
Roger, flight, Mr. Smith said.
We saw Miss Phillips pull on Dr. Canterbury's wrist, rotating him so that he was facing her. She reached to pull the harness around him.
Dr. Canterbury's eyes opened. He jerked and hit the hand controller. The two historians tumbled. Out the window, the gray lunar surface was replaced by darkness, and then surface again in rapid succession.
They're spinning.
Mr. Smith pulled the hand controller to one side and released it. After a short delay, I noted that the view rotated more slowly.
Flight guidance LM is in stable BBQ mode.
Nice flying, Mr. Smith, the Capcom said. My guy in the simulator says you used about half the fuel he would have.
She's not out of the woods yet, he said. Look at the disk key.
Huh? There were no woods on the moon. And what kind of a disk had a key?
Click. I yanked the plug for my laptop.
Mr. Smith continued talking.
Apolloon is...
Sorry, I think we've lost our link to the spacecraft, I said, looking at Dr. Winkler. He, in turn, was looking at Ms. Pressa.
Ms. Pressa was texting quietly on her phone.
Communications restored, she declared.
I took the hint and plugged Mr. Smith back in. A text message appeared on my laptop saying, not out of the woods means not out of trouble. DSKY is a display in the LM.
None of that was nonsense?
My face burned with embarrassment. I had a lot to learn.
The guidance team reported that they had the orbital correction calculated, including the additional jet firings. The flight director gave them the go to have the automatic system command the jet to make the necessary corrections. Capcom warned Ms. Phillips that there will be jet firings. Ms. Phillips got Dr. Canterbury secured in his harness and tightened her own. His eyes had closed again. Surgeon feared that the acceleration, though gentle compared to an Earth launch, might have exacerbated his injuries. After the maneuver, the trajectory plot showed that the LM and Pac-Man cargo ship would rendezvous on schedule. Capcom informed a relieved Ms. Phillips that all was well.
"Except she's going to crash," Mr. Smith said.
"What?"
I rested my fingers on the headset connection.
"Mr. Smith, flight speaking, the trajectory looks good to us. Why do you think she's going to crash?"
"I told you. Look at the disk key. You only raised Appaloon from 40.1 to 40.6. That's too low for the CSM.
A text appeared on my laptop saying, "Appaloon is the highest point in a lunar orbit. CSM equals command and service module." I looked up at Ms. Pressa and nodded to let her know I understood. I pulled my hand away from the connection. Mr. Smith continued, "You need 42 nautical miles or the CSM can't get to her in time."
"Nautical miles? What kind of dumb unit is that?" I blurted, and then covered my mouth.
I hadn't meant to say that out loud for the whole team to hear. Ms. Pressa frowned, I assumed at my outburst, and texted furiously. Nothing showed up on my laptop, though.
"Break, break," Capcom interrupted.
"Lunar Ops reports the LM is out of range by about 10 kilometers.
Mr. Smith was right?
"Guidance flight, we've uncovered the problem. The LM software uses nautical miles, and the corrections we made assumed statute miles. We're off by a factor of 1.15. Ms. Pressa rose from her seat and paced back and forth. Not out of the woods, indeed.
"Guidance, get me the right numbers for Mr. Smith to fly to. Capcom, inform Ms. Phillips we'll be doing another maneuver."
Precious time ticked by while the LM rapidly approached the point of no return. The trajectory map refreshed with a new image showing the LM arcing up but not quite reaching the intersect point with the cargo ship. Unless it changed course fast, the historians were doomed. If I hadn't cut off Mr. Smith's comments earlier, would they have discovered the problem sooner? Was this all my fault? Maybe I didn't have the right stuff to be a pilot after all. Lunar Ops reported that she had moved the cargo ship to a slightly lower orbit that would help close the gap, but it also increased her speed. That seemed counterproductive to me until I saw on the plot that the intersection point was farther around the moon than predicted earlier. Orbital mechanics was confusing. Finally, guidance reported they had the commands ready. The flight director said to execute them. If anything went wrong, we would know in a few minutes. If so, we might need Mr. Smith to fly to the numbers manually. Ms. Pressa approached and held up her phone. I heard the shutter sound of a camera snapping a photo.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Mr. Smith shouted. Ms. Pressa looked puzzled.
"Just taking your picture, Grandpa," she explained.
Uh-oh, he didn't like to be called that.
"Grandpa, you didn't think I was too old at the bar the other night?"
He squinted at her badge.
"P-R-E-S-S, you're a reporter, get out!"
He pushed her back with the heel of his big left hand. Her phone clattered across the floor, and she fell back into a chair. The security guard from the door seemed to appear out of thin air.
"Director, are you okay?" he asked, lifting her to her feet.
"Director? Of what?"
"I'm okay, Harry," Miss Pressa insisted, smoothing her suit jacket.
"There's just been a misunderstanding." Dr. Winkler handed her phone to Harry.
Escort me to the door, please.
Whatever you say, ma'am, the big guy replied, glaring at Mr. Smith.
Paparazzi, Mr. Smith cursed.
Dr. Winkler poured Mr. Smith a glass of water from a pitcher on a nearby table. He'd handed it to him and assured him that everything was under control. I'd never seen the doctor so rattled. Having a patient almost flatten his great-granddaughter was rather upsetting. The doctor met my eyes and then darted his glance to and from the water glass. I understood that he had added something to the water. Then he said,
"Sir, I suggest that you rest your feet while we wait for communications to come back."
"Are they in blackout?" Mr. Smith asked. "Yes," I agreed, holding the plugs to his headset and the speaker out of view. All of Mission Control had heard his outburst at Ms. Pressa. I hoped they didn't realize that she really was his great-granddaughter. Even though Pressa was probably her married name, some enterprising person could use it to figure out Mr. Smith's identity. Mr. Smith gulped the water like he was taking a shot of scotch. He settled onto the stool, glancing down at his feet.
"Man, I hate these stiff military shoes. When I retire, I'm only going to wear slippers."
"Your mother won't like that," I quipped. He smiled.
"No, she won't," he agreed. "And that's another reason I'm going to wear slippers."
He laughed.
I was dying to know what was going on with Ms. Phillips. The trajectory display on the TV was blinking. In all the commotion, the maneuver had come and gone. He couldn't do any harm now. "We're getting the signal back," I said, and plugged Mr. Smith and the speaker back in. Guidance reported that he was waiting for Lunar Ops to confirm target acquisition. Mr. Smith surprised me when he calmly said,
"Miss Phillips, quit worrying about the trajectory for a minute. Look out the window. You owe it to yourself."
I wasn't sure if Mission Control had let this message through until Miss Phillips said,
"Seeing the Earth above the desolate moon reminds me of just how precious life is. I'll never forget this moment."
"Me either,"
Mr. Smith said.
"Me either," I whispered.
Lunar Ops reported target acquired. I sagged onto my stool, suddenly realizing how tired I was. Some fancy remote flying on the part of Lunar Ops completed the rendezvous. The cargo ship scooped the LM into its wide bay, and cheers erupted in Mission Control. I gave Mr. Smith a high five, and Dr. Winkler patted him firmly on the back.
"Where are the cigars?" Mr. Smith asked.
"Sorry, but this is a no-smoking area," Dr. Winkler said.
"Oh,"
Mr. Smith said, obviously disappointed.
A text appeared on my laptop.
"Good call on the nautical miles. You saved 2 lives. Sorry about the photo. Forgot blackmail incident still upsets him. I'll be in touch. Thanks again."
She signed it R.E. Pressa, Director of Knowledge Capture, Department of Homeland Security.
Knowledge capture?
After the cargo hold was pressurized, Ms. Phillips was able to take off her spacesuit and help Dr. Canterbury out of his. The flight surgeon did a remote exam. Turned out that Dr. Canterbury didn't have a concussion. His suit had been damaged, and he was suffering from carbon dioxide poisoning. If they hadn't done the direct descent, he would have died. Ms. Phillips hooked him up to oxygen and settled in to wait for the Russian rescue ship to rendezvous with them. Mr. Smith's advice no longer needed, Mission Control cut our connection. We were now in listen-only mode. Dr. Winkler escorted a sleepy Mr. Smith to the men's room, while I moved the chairs back to their proper places in the lounge. Just before I unplugged the speaker box, I heard Ms. Phillips thank the team in Houston for sending the cargo ship, and especially for recruiting Mr. Smith to help her.
"I have dedicated my life to preserving the history of space," she said. "Yet today, when I was faced with having to recreate that history, I realized just how little I actually know.
I now have a new level of understanding and respect for the courage and skill of the Apollo astronauts. I hope that I'll have the opportunity to thank Mr. Smith in person when I get back. I knew that wasn't going to happen. By the time she got back, he'd already have forgotten all about this day. But I wouldn't. I would remember for him. And tomorrow, I'd check out every ebook and disc I could find at the library and read all about the Apollo program and the amazing men who first walked on the moon. We'd watch that Apollo movie with Tom Hanks and fly simulations together. Though Mr. Smith might soon forget even his real name and wouldn't remember Ms. Phillips next week, my memories of this time with him would be as long-lasting as his footprints on the moon.
Taiki and the Ants, Hannu Rajaniemi. The ants arrived on the moon on the same day Taiki went through the secret door to give a ruby to the magician. She was glad to be out of the base. The brain had given her a treatment earlier that morning, and that always left her tingly and nervous, with pent-up energy that could only be expended by running down the grey rolling slope down the side of Malapert Mountain, jumping and hooting.
"Come on, keep up!" she shouted,
at the grag that the brain had inevitably sent to keep an eye on her. The white-skinned machine followed her on its two thick treads, cylindrical arms swaying for balance as it rumbled laboriously downhill, following the little craters of Taiki's footprints. Exasperated, she crossed her arms and paused to wait. She looked up. The mouth of the base was hidden from view, as it should be, to keep them safe from space sharks. The jagged edge of the mountain hid the great wrong place from sight. Except for a single wink of blue malice, just above the gleaming white of the upper slopes, a stark contrast against the velvet black of the sky. The white was not snow, that was a wrong place thing, but tiny beads of glass made by ancient meteor impacts. That's what the brain said anyway. According to Changa, the moon girl, it was all the jewels she had lost over the centuries she had lived there. Taiki preferred Changa's version, that made her think of the ruby, and she touched her belt pouch to make sure it was still there. "Outings are subject to being escorted at all times," said the sonorous voice of the brain in her helmet. "There is no reason to be impatient." Most of the grags were autonomous. The brain could only control a few of them at a time. But of course, it would keep an eye on her so soon after the treatment.
"Yes, there is, slowpoke," Taiki muttered, stretching her arms and jumping up and down in frustration.
Her suit flexed and flowed around her with the movement. She had grown it herself as well, the third one so far, although it had taken much longer than the ruby. Its many layers were alive. It felt light, and best of all, it had a power skin, a slick, porous tissue made from cells with mechanosensitive iron channels that translated her movements into power for the suit. It was so much better than the white, clumsy fabric ones the Chinese had left behind. The Grags had cut and sewn a baby-sized version out of those for her. That kind of worked, but was impossibly stuffy and stiff. It was only the second time she had tested the new suit, and she was proud of it. It was practically a wearable ecosystem, and she was pretty sure that with its photosynthesis layer, it would keep her alive for months if she only had enough sunlight and carried enough of the horrible compressed Chinese nutrients. She frowned. Her legs were suddenly grey, mottled with browns. She brushed them with her hand and her fingers. Slick, silvery hue of the power skin came away the same color. It seemed the regolith dust clung to the suit. Annoying. She absently noted to do something about it for the next iteration when she fed the suit back into the base's big biofabber. Now the grag was stuck on the lip of a shallow crater, grinding treads sending up silent parabolas of little rocks and dust. Taiki had had enough of waiting.
"I'll be back for dinner," she told the brain.
Without waiting for the base mind's response, she switched off the radio, turned around, and started running. Taiki settled into the easy stride the jade rabbit had shown her, gliding just above the surface, using well-timed toe pushes to cross craters and small rocks that littered the uneven regolith. She took the long way around, avoiding her old tracks that ran down much of the slope, just to confuse the poor grag more. She skirted around the edge of one of the pitch-black cold fingers, deeper craters that never got sunlight, that were everywhere on this side of the mountain. It would have been a shortcut,
but it was too cold for her suit. Besides, the Ink Men lived in the deep potholes in the other moon beyond the door. Halfway around, the ground suddenly shook. Taiki slid uncontrollably, almost going over the edge, before she managed to stop by turning around mid-leap and jamming her toes into the chilly, hard regolith when she landed. Her heart pounded. Had the Ink Men brought something up from the deep dark? Something big? Or had she just been almost hit by a meteorite? That had happened a couple of times, a sudden crater blooming soundlessly into being right next to her. Then she saw beams of light in the blackness, and realized that it was only the base's sandworm, a giant articulated machine with a maw full of toothy wheels that ground helium-3 and other volatiles from the deep shadowy deposits. Taiki breathed a sigh of relief and continued on her way. Many of the grag bodies were ugly, but she liked the sandworm. She had helped to program it, constantly toiling. It went into such deep places that the brain could not control it remotely. The secret door was in a shallow crater, maybe 100 meters in diameter. She went down its slope with little choppy leaps and stopped her momentum with a deft pirouette and toe break right in front of the door. It was made of 2 large pyramid-shaped rocks, leaning against each other at a funny angle, with a small triangular gap between them. The big old one and the troll. The old one had 2 eyes made from shadows, and when Taiki squinted from the right angle, a rough outcrop and a groove in the base became a nose and a mouth. The troll looked grumpy, half squashed against the bigger rock's bulk. As she watched, the face of the old one became alive and gave her a quizzical look. Taiki gave it a stiff bow out of habit, even though she could have curtsied in her new suit.
"How have you been, Taiki?" the rock asked in its silent voice.
"I had a treatment today," she said dourly. The rock could not nod, so it raised its eyebrows.
"Ah, always treatments. Let me tell you, in my day, vacuum was the only treatment we had, and the sun and a little meteorite every now and then to keep it clean. Stick to that and you'll live to be as old as I am." "I was fat," grumbled the troll. "Believe me, once you carry him for a few million years, you start to feel it. What are you doing here anyway?"
Taiki grinned. "I made a ruby for the magician." She took it out and held it up proudly. She squeezed it a bit, careful not to damage her suit's gloves against the rough edges, and held it in the old one's jet-black shadow, knocking it against the rock's surface. It sparkled with tiny embers, just like it was supposed to. She had made it herself, using Vinoy flame fusion, and spiced it with piezoelectric material so that it would convert motion to light.
"It's very beautiful, Taiki," the old one said. "I'm sure he will love it." "Oh," said the troll. "Well, maybe the old fool will finally stop looking for the Queen Ruby then and settle down with poor Changa. In with you now. You're encouraging this sentimental piece of rubble here. He might start crying. Besides, everybody is waiting."
Taiki closed her eyes, counted to 10, and crawled through the opening between the rocks, through the secret door to her other moon. The moment Taiki opened her eyes, she saw that something was wrong. The house of the Jade Rabbit was broken. The boulders she had carefully balanced on top of each other lay scattered on the ground, and the lines she had drawn to make the rooms and the furniture were smudged. Since it never rained, the house had not needed a roof. There was a silent sob. Changa the Moon Girl sat next to the rabbit's house, crying. Her flowing silk robes of purple, yellow, and red were a mess on the ground like broken wings, and her makeup had been running down her pale, powdered face.
"Oh, Taiki," she cried. "It is terrible, terrible."
She wiped a crystal tear from her eye. It evaporated in the vacuum before it could fall on the dust. Changa was a drama queen, and pretty, and knew it too. Once, she had an affair with the woodcutter just because she was bored and bore him children. But they were already grown up and moved to the dark side. Taiki put her hands on her hips, suddenly angry.
"Who did this?" she asked. "Was it the cheese goat?"
Tearful, Changa shook her head.
"General Nutsy Nutsy? Or Mr. Cute?"
The moon people had many enemies, and there had been times when Taiki had led them in great battles, cutting her way through armies of stone with an aluminium rod the magician had enchanted into a terrible bright blade. But none of them had ever been so mean as to smash the houses.
"Who was it then?"
Changa hid her face behind one flowing silken sleeve and pointed. And that's when Taiki saw the first ant,
moving in the ruins of the Jade Rabbit's house. It was not like a Grag or an Otho, and certainly not a moon person. It was a jumbled metal frame, all angles and shiny rods, like a vector calculation come to life, too straight and rigid against the rough surfaces of the rocks to be real. It was like two tetrahedrons inside each other, with a bulbous sphere at each vertex, each glittering like the eye of the great wrong place. It was not big, perhaps reaching up to Tyche's knees. One of the telescoping metal struts had white letters on it. ANT-A3972, they said, even though the thing did not look like the ants Tyche had seen in videos. It stretched and moved like the geometrical figures Tyche manipulated with a gesture during the brain's math lessons. Suddenly it flipped over the rabbit's broken wall, making Tyche gasp. Then it shifted into a strange, slug-like motion over the regolith, first stretching, then contracting. It made Tyche's skin crawl. As she watched, the ant thing fell into a crevice between two boulders, but dexterously pulled itself up, supported itself on a couple of vertices, and somersaulted over the obstacle like an acrobat. Tyche stared at it. Anger started to build up in her chest. In the base, she obeyed the brain and the Othos and the Grags because she had promised. But the other moon was her place. It belonged to her and the moon people and no one else.
"Everybody else is hiding," whispered Changa. "You have to do something, Tyche. Chase it away."
"Where is the magician?" Tyche asked. "He would know what to do." She did not like the way the ant thing moved. As she hesitated, the creature swung around and, with a series of twitches, pulled itself up into a pyramid as if watching her. "It's not so nasty looking," Tyche thought. "Maybe I could bring it back to the base, introduce it to Hugbear." It would be a complex operation. She would have to assure the bear that she would always love it no matter what, and then carefully introduce the newcomer to it. The ant thing darted forward, and a sharp pain stung Tyche's thigh. One of the thing's vertices had a spike that quickly retracted. Tyche's suit grumbled as it sealed all its 21 layers and soothed the tiny wound. Tears came to her eyes, and her mouth was suddenly dry. No moon person had ever hurt her, not even the ink men, except to pretend. She almost switched her radio on and called the Grag for help. Then she felt the eyes of the moon people, looking at her from their windows. She gritted her teeth and ignored the bite of the wound. She was Tyche. She was brave. Had she not climbed to the peak of eternal light once all alone, following the solar panel cables just to look the great wrong place in the eye? It had been smaller than she'd expected, tiny and blue and unblinking, with a bit of white and green and altogether a disappointment. Carefully, Tyche picked up a good-sized rock from the Jade Rabbit's wall. It was broken anyway. She took a slow step towards the creature. It had suddenly contracted into something resembling a cube and seemed to be absorbed in something. Tyche moved right. The ant flinched at her shadow. She moved left and swung the rock down as hard as she could. She missed. The momentum took her down. Her knees hit the hard, chilly regolith. The rock bounced away. This time the tears came, but Tyche struggled up and threw the rock after the creature. It was scrambling away up the slope of the crater. Tyche picked up the rock and followed. In spite of the steep climb, she gained on it with a few determined leaps, cheered on by the moon people below. She was right at its heels when it climbed over the edge of the crater. But when she caught a glimpse of what lay beyond, she froze and dropped down on her belly. A bright patch of sunlight shone on the wide highland plain ahead. It was crawling with ants, hundreds of them. A rectangular carpet of them sat right in the middle, all joined together into a thick metal sheet. Every now and then, it undulated like something soft, a shiny amoeba. Other ant things moved in orderly rows, sweeping the surroundings. The one Tyche was following picked up speed on the level ground, rolling and bouncing, like a skeletal football, and as she watched from her hiding place, it joined the central mass. Immediately, the ant sheet changed. Its side stretched upwards into a hollow, cup-like shape. Other ants at its base telescoped into a high supporting structure, lifting it up. A sharp spike grew in the middle of the cup, and then the whole structure turned to point at the sky. A transmitter, Tyche thought, following it with her gaze. It was aimed straight at the great wrong place. Tyche swallowed, turned around and slid back down. She was almost glad to see the Grag down there, waiting for her patiently by the secret door. The brain did not sound angry, but then the brain was never angry. Evacuation procedure has been initiated, it said. This location has been compromised. Taiki was breathing hard. The base was in a lava tube halfway up the south slope of the mountain, and the way up was always harder than the way down. This time, the Grag had had no trouble keeping up with her. It had been a silent journey. She had tried to tell the brain about the ants, but the AI had maintained complete radio silence until they were inside the base.
What do you mean, evacuation?
Taiki demanded. She opened the helmet of her suit and breathed in the comfortable, yeasty smell of her home module. Her little home was converted from one of the old Chinese ones, snug white cylinders that huddled close to the main entrance of the cavernous lava tube. She always thought they looked like the front teeth in the mouth of a big snake. The main tube itself was partially pressurized, over 60 meters in diameter, and burrowed deep into the mountain. It split into many branches, expanded and reinforced by Othos and Grags with regolith concrete pillars. She had tried to play there many times, but preferred the other moon. She did not like the stench from the bacteria that the Othos seeded the walls with, the ones that pooped calcium and aluminium. Now it was a hotbed of activity. The Grags had set up bright lights and moved around, disassembling equipment and filling cryogenic tanks. The walls were alive with the tiny, soft starfish-like Othos, eating bacteria away. The brain had not wasted any time. We are leaving, Taiki, the brain said. You need to get ready. The probe you found knows we are here. We are going away to another place. A safer place. Do not worry. We have alternative locations prepared. It will be fine. Taiki bit her lip. It's my fault. She wished the brain had a proper face. It had a module for its own in the coldest, unpressurized part of the tube, where its quantum processors could operate undisturbed. But inside, it was just lasers and lenses and trapped ions and rat brain cells grown to mesh with circuitry. How could it understand about the Jade Rabbit's house? It wasn't fair. And before we go, you need a treatment. Going away. She tried to wrap her mind around the concept. They'd always been here, to be safe from the space sharks from the Great Wrong Place. And the secret door was here. If they went somewhere else, how would she find her way to the other moon? How would the moon people do without her? And she still hadn't given the ruby to the magician. The anger and fatigue exploded out of her in one hot, wet burst. I'm not going to go, not going to go, not going to go, she said, and ran into her sleeping cubicle. I don't want a stupid treatment, she yelled, letting the door membrane congeal shut behind her. Taiki took off her suit, flung it into a corner and cuddled against the hugbear in her bed. Its ragged fur felt warm against her cheek, and its fake heartbeat was reassuring. She distantly remembered her mum had made it move from afar sometimes, stroked her hair with its paws, its round face screen replaced with her features. That had been a long time ago, and she was sure the bear was bigger then, but it was still soft. Suddenly, the bear moved. Her heart jumped with a strange, aching hope, but it was only the brain. Go away, she muttered. Taiki, this is important, said the brain. Do you remember what you promised? She shook her head. Her eyes were hot and wet. I'm not going to cry like Changa, she thought. I'm not. Do you remember now? The bear's face was replaced with a man and a woman. The man had no hair, and his dark skin glistened. The woman was raven-haired and pale, with a face like a bird. Mum is even prettier than Changa, Taiki thought. Hello, Taiki, they said in unison and laughed. We are Kareem and Sophia, the woman said. We are your mommy and daddy. We hope you are well when you see this. She touched the screen quickly and lightly, like a little bunny hop on the regolith. But if the brain is showing you this, Taiki's dad said, then it means that something bad has happened and you need to do what the brain tells you. You should not be angry at the brain, Mum said. It is not like we are. It just plans and thinks. It just does what it was told to do. And we told it to keep you safe. You see, in the Great Wrong Place, people like us could not be safe, Dad continued. People like Mum and me and you were feared. They called us Greys, after the man who figured out how to make us, and they were jealous because we lived longer than they did and had more time to figure things out. And because giving things silly names makes people feel better about themselves. Do we look grey to you? No, Taiki shook her head. The magician was grey, but that was because he was always looking for rubies in dark places and never saw the sun. So we came here to build a right place, just the two of us. Her dad squeezed Mum's shoulders, just like the bear used to do to Taiki. And you were born here. You can't imagine how happy we were. Then Mum looked serious. But we knew that the wrong place people might come looking for us, so we had to hide you, to make sure you would be safe, so they would not look inside you and cut you and find out what makes you work. They would do anything to have you. Fear crunched Taiki's gut into a tiny cold ball. Cut you? It was very, very hard, dear Taiki, because we love you. Very hard, not to touch you except from afar. But we want you to grow big and strong, and when the time comes, we will come and find you, and then we will all be in the right place together. But you have to promise to take your treatments. Can you promise to do that? Can you promise to do what the brain says?
I promise, Taiki muttered.
Goodbye, Taiki, her parents said. We will see you soon. And then they were gone, and the hug bear's face was blank and pale brown again. We need to go soon, the brain said again, and this time its voice sounded more gentle. Please get ready. I would like you to have a treatment before travel. Taiki sighed and nodded. It wasn't fair, but she had promised. The brain sent Taiki a list of things she could take with her, scrolling in one of the windows of her room. It was a short list. She looked around at the fabbed figurines and the moon rock that she had thought looked like a boy, and the e-sheets floating everywhere with her favorite stories open. She could not even take the hug bear. She felt alone suddenly, like she had when she had climbed to look at the great wrong place on top of the mountain. Then she noticed the ruby lying on her bed. If I go away and take it with me, the magician will never find it. She thought about the magician and his panther, desperately looking from crater to crater forever. It's not fair. Even if I keep my promise, I'll have to take it to him. And say goodbye. Taiki sat down on the bed and thought very hard. The brain was everywhere, but it could not watch everything. It was based on a scanned human brain, some poor person who had died a long time ago. It had no cameras in her room, and its attention would be on the evacuation. It would have to keep programming and reprogramming the grags. She picked at the sensor bracelet in her wrist that monitored her life signs and location. That was the difficult bit. She would have to do something about that. But there wasn't much time. The brain would take her for a treatment soon. She hugged the bear again in frustration. It felt warm, and as she squeezed it hard, she could feel its pulse. Taiki sat up. She remembered the jade rabbit's stories and tricks, the tar rabbit he had made to trick an enemy. She reached into the hug bear's head and pulled out a programming window, coupled it with her sensor. She summoned up old data logs, added some noise to them. Then she fed them to the bear, watched its pulse and breathing and other simulated life signs change to match hers. Then she took a deep breath, and as quickly as she could, she pulled off the bracelet and put it on the hug bear. Taiki? Is there something wrong? The brain asked. Taiki's heart jumped. Her mind raced.
It's fine, she said. I think I just banged my sensor a bit. I'm just getting ready now.
She tried to make her voice sound sweet, like a girl who always keeps her promises. Your treatment will be ready soon, the brain said, and was gone. Heart pounding, Taiki started to put on her suit. There was a game that Taiki used to play in the lava tube. How far could she get before she was spotted by the grags? She played it now, staying low, avoiding their camera eyes, hiding behind rock protrusions, crates and cryogenic tanks, until she was in a tube branch that only had Othos in it. The brain did not usually control them directly, and besides, they did not have eyes. Still, her heart felt like meteorite impacts in her chest. She pushed through a semi-pressurizing membrane. In this branch, the Othos had dug too deep for calcium and caused a roof collapse. In the dim green light of her suit's fluorescence, she made her way up the tube slope. There. She climbed on a pile of rubble carefully. The Othos had once told her there was an opening there, and she hoped it would be big enough for her to squeeze through. Boulders rolled under her, and she felt a sharp bang against her knee. The suit hissed at the sudden impact. She ignored the pain and ran her fingers along the rocks, following a very faint air current she could not have sensed without the suit. Then her fingers met regolith instead of rock. It was packed tight, and she had to push hard at it with her aluminium rod before it gave way. A shower of dust and rubble fell on her, and for a moment she thought there was going to be another collapse.
but then there was a patch of velvet sky in front of her. She widened the opening, made herself as small as she could, and crawled towards it. Taiki emerged onto the mountainside. The sudden wide open space of rolling grey and brown around her felt like the time she had eaten too much sugar. Her legs and hands were wobbly, and she had to sit down for a moment. She shook herself. She had an appointment to keep. She checked that the ruby was still in its pouch, got up, and started downwards with the rabbit slope. The secret door was just the way Taiki had left it. She eyed the crater edge nervously, but there were no ants in sight. She bit her lip when she looked at the old one and the troll. "What's wrong?" the old one asked.
"I'm going to have to go away."
"Don't worry. We'll still be here when you come back."
"I might never come back," Taiki said, choking a bit.
"Never is a very long time," the old one said. "Even I have never seen never. We'll be here. Take care, Taiki."
Taiki crawled through to the other moon and found the magician waiting for her. He was very thin and tall, taller than the old one even, and cast a long, cold finger of a shadow in the crater. He had a sad face and a scraggly beard and white gloves and a tall top hat. Next to him lay his flying panther, all black, with eyes like tiny rubies.
"Hello, Taiki," the magician said, with a voice like the rumble of a sandworm.
Taiki swallowed and took out the ruby from her pouch, holding it out to him. "I made this for you. What if he doesn't like it?"
But the magician picked it up, slowly, eyes glowing, held it in both hands and gazed at it in awe.
"That is very, very kind of you," he whispered. Very carefully, he took off his hat and put the ruby in it. It was the first time Taiki had ever seen the magician smile. Still, there was a sadness to his expression.
"I didn't want to leave before giving it to you," she said.
"That's quite a fuss you caused for the brain. He is going to be very worried."
"He deserves it. But I promised I would go with him."
The magician looked at the ruby one more time and put the hat back on his head.
"Normally, I don't interfere with the affairs of other people, but for this, I owe you a wish."
Taiki took a deep breath.
"I don't want to live with the Grags and the Othos and the brain anymore. I want to be in the right place with Mum and Dad."
The magician looked at her sadly.
"I'm sorry, Taiki, but I can't make that happen. My magic is not powerful enough."
"But they promised."
"Taiki, I know you don't remember, and that's why we moon people remember for you. The space sharks came and took your parents a long time ago. They're dead. I'm sorry."
Taiki closed her eyes. A picture in a window, a domed crater. Two bright things arcing over the horizon like sharks, then brightness.
"You've lived with the brain ever since. You don't remember because it makes you forget with the treatments, so you don't get too sad. So you stay the way your parents wanted to keep you. But we remember, and we always tell you the truth."
And suddenly, they were all there, all the moon people, coming from their houses. Changa and her children and the jade rabbit and the woodcutter, looking at her gravely and nodding their heads. Taiki could not bear to look at them. She covered her helmet with her hands, turned around, crawled through the secret door and ran away, away from the other moon. She ran, not a rabbit run, but a clumsy, jerky, crying run, until she stumbled on a boulder and went rolling, hickledy-pickledy down. She lay curled up in the chilly regolith for a long time, and when she opened her eyes, the ants were all around her. The ants were arranged around her in a half-circle, stretched into spiky pyramids, waving slightly, as if looking for something. Then they spoke. At first, it was just noise, hissing in her helmet. But after a second, it resolved into a voice.
"Hello," it said, warm and female, like Changa, but older and deeper. "I am Alyssa. Are you hurt?"
Taiki was frozen. She had never spoken to anyone who was not the brain or one of the moon people. Her tongue felt stiff.
"Just tell me if you are all right. No one is going to hurt you. Do you feel bad anywhere?"
"No," Taiki breathed. "There is no need to be afraid. We will take you home." A video feed flashed up inside her helmet,
a spaceship that was made up of a cluster of legs and a globe that glinted golden. A circle appeared elsewhere in her field of vision, indicating a tiny pinpoint of light in the sky. See? We are on our way.
I don't want to go to the great wrong place, she gasped. I don't want you to cut me up.
There was a pause. Why would we do that? There is nothing to be afraid of.
Because wrong place people don't like people like me.
Another pause. Dear child, I don't know what you have been told, but things have changed. Your parents left Earth more than a century ago. We never thought we would find you, but we kept looking. And I'm glad we did. You have been alone on the moon for a very long time.
Taiki got up slowly. I haven't been alone. Her head spun. They would do anything to have you. She backed off a few steps.
If I come with you, she asked in a small voice, will I see Karim and Sophia again?
A pause again, longer this time.
Of course you will, Alyssa the ant woman said finally. They're right here, waiting for you.
Liar. Slowly, Taiki started backing off. The ants moved, closing their circle. I am faster than they are, she thought. They can't catch me.
Where are you going?
Taiki switched off her radio, cleared the circle of the ants with a leap, and hit the ground running. Taiki ran, faster than she had ever run before, faster even than when the jade rabbit challenged her to a race across the Shackleton crater. Finally, her lungs and legs burned and she had to stop. She had set out without direction, but had gone up the mountain slope, close to the cold fingers.
I don't want to go back to the base. The brain never tells the truth either.
Black dots danced in her eyes.
They'll never catch me.
She looked back, down towards the crater of the secret door. The ants were moving. They gathered into the metal sheet again. Then its sides stretched upwards until they met and formed a tubular structure. It elongated and weaved back and forth and slithered forward, faster than even Taiki could run, a metal snake. The pyramid shapes of the ants glinted in its head like teeth. Faster and faster it came, flowing over boulders and craters like it was weightless, a curtain of billowing dust behind it. She looked around for a hiding place, but she was on open ground now, except for the dark pool of the mining crater to the west. Then she remembered something the jade rabbit had once said. For anything that wants to eat you, there is something bigger that wants to eat it. The ant snake was barely 100 meters behind her now, flipping back and forth in sinusoid waves on the regolith, like a shiny metal whip. She stuck out her tongue at it, accidentally tasting the sweet inner surface of her helmet. Then she made it to the sunless crater's edge. With a few bounds, she was over the crater lip. It was like diving into icy water. Her suit groaned as she could feel its joints stiffening up. But she kept going, towards the bottom, almost blind from the contrast between the pitch black and the bright sun above. She followed the vibration in her soles. Boulders and pebbles rained on her helmet, and she knew the ant snake was right at her heels. The lights of the sandworm almost blinded her. Now! She leapt up, as high as she could. Feeling weightless, reached out for the utility ladder that she knew was on the huge machine's topside. She grabbed it, banged painfully against the worm's side, felt its thunder beneath her. And then, a grinding, shuddering vibration as the mining machine bit into the ant snake, rolling right over it. Metal fragments flew into the air, glowing red hot. One of them landed on Taiki's arm. The suit made a bubble around it and spat it out. The sandworm came to an emergency halt, and Taiki almost fell off. It started disgorging its little repair grags, and Taiki felt a stab of guilt. She sat still until her breathing calmed down, and Suit's complaints about the cold got too loud. Then she dropped to the ground and started the climb back up, towards the secret door. There were still a few ants left around the secret door, but Taiki ignored them. They were rolling around aimlessly, and there weren't enough of them to build a transmitter. She looked up. The ship from the Great Wrong Place was still a distant star. She still had time. Painfully, bruised limbs aching, she crawled through the secret door one last time. The moon people were still there, waiting for her. Taiki looked at them in the eye, one by one. Then she put her hands on her hips.
I have a wish, she said. I am going to go away. I'm going to make the brain obey me this time. I'm going to go and build a right place, all on my own. I'm never going to forget again. So I want you all to come with me.
she looked up at the magician. Can you do that? Smiling, the man in the top hat nodded, spread his white-gloved fingers and whirled his cloak that had a bright red inner lining, like a ruby. Taiki blinked. The other moon was gone. She looked around. She was standing on the other side of the old one and the troll, except that they looked just like rocks now, and the moon people were inside her. I should feel heavier carrying so many people, she thought. But instead, she was empty and light. Uncertainly at first, then with more confidence, she started walking back up Malapert Mountain towards the base. Her step was not a rabbit's, nor a panther's, nor a maiden's silky tiptoe, just her very own.